Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of souls.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Good evening, everyone. As with the previous 4 episodes in this series, we are going to jump back in tonight and pick up right where we left off. As I mentioned in previous episodes, it's beneficial to you to listen to this series in episode order to ensure that you can easily understand what is being discussed and so that you don't miss out on any crucial details. So, my friends, buckle up, because tonight we are going to finish this. This is The Case of the West Memphis 3, Part 5. Part 1. The Satanic Panic. A few weeks ago, I released an episode dedicated solely to the subject of the Satanic Panic. It referenced the West Memphis case quite a bit. I recommend checking that episode out for further clarity surrounding this topic. It's a deep dive into a culture that has all but been resigned to the history books. This case has become linked tightly with the fear that swept Western nations throughout most of the 1980s and 90s. Hell, you bring up this case, and the first words out of most people's mouths will be something about teenagers dressing in black and a town convinced the devil was going to murder them in their sleep. The 80s and 90s were a different time, and I don't think those born after those decades realized just how different the cultural zeitgeist really was back then. The beginnings. A large portion of the West Memphis police investigation was centered around investigating some sort of mysterious cult that could have committed the murders. But how much was driven by the police themselves and how much was caused by the residents of the small town is unclear. Some officers like Steve Jones, James Sudbury, and Jerry Driver believed adamantly in the occult's involvement from a very early period. Others seemed less convinced and focused their efforts on strangers coming to the area or known sexual predators. I bring up the question about who was driving the occult angle because one of the most interesting aspects of the police investigation was the sheer number of statements that all had to do with some sort of cult taking place in the area. Witness after witness claimed to have seen strange people with blackened faces being part of some sort of devil worship cabal in the woods, or even directly named individuals like Damien or alternate suspect David W., or Damien's friend Chris L., as being involved in local devil worship cults. Some people actually did admit that they were part of some sort of witchy occult group, though they generally specified they were a white witch group and said that they weren't involved in black magic rituals. The one exception was Damien's ex-girlfriend, Deanna, who told the police straight up that she was a black witch that practiced alone. Whether this occurred because the police specifically asked about it, or whether it was brought up naturally during the investigation, is puzzling and hard to identify, since many of the reports were taken in the form of the written notes, not as taped statements or conversations. One interesting thing to note is that the 32-page questionnaire given to serious suspects prior to any arrests had several questions about whether or not they owned a Bible, practiced white or black magic, or believed in God or the devil. This shows that the occult was an angle that the police were exploring very early on. I also mentioned in a previous episode that the police received a list of names, a list of teenagers in the area that may be involved in cult activity. The police managed to interview a significant number of them. The Hutchisons. Vicky and Aaron Hutchison were crucial witnesses. They both provided important testimony about the supposed cult to the West Memphis Police Department, but they also seriously implicated Damien as a suspect. Despite their key role in getting the 3 suspects arrested, what they actually had to say is both tortured and confusing. However, they do provide some interesting insight into the investigation, and Vicky would later give some interesting testimony after the three teenagers had been convicted. Aaron Hutchison was an 8-year-old boy at the time of the crimes who was good friends with the three victims. On May 6th, Vicky was brought into the city of Marion Police Station, a nearby town to West Memphis. She was brought in to answer questions about bad checks that had been forged at her workplace. An officer named Don Bray informed her that Aaron's friends were missing. Bray talked to Aaron alone before interviewing the boy several more times afterwards. Bray also encouraged Vicky and Aaron to ask around and try to find as much information as they could about witchcraft and the occult in the area. Aaron's first interview with the police that occurred on record was on May 27th, 1993, where he told police lots of things about the Robin Hood Hills. The most important part of his testimony was that a cult of men used to meet in the hills, most of whom wore black clothing and had sex with each other and murdered animals. Other identifying parts of the cult, according to Aaron, included a briefcase, which was also a staple in Jesse Miskelly's confession about the cult he was supposedly involved in, a skull necklace, and an ugly, ratty hair. Aaron also said that along with Michael Moore and Christopher Byers, he used to watch the men from their playhouse in the woods. Aaron's claims got wilder the more he was interviewed in the month of June, however. All of a sudden, on June 4th, 1993, Aaron changed his story to tell the police that he was there too, and that he somehow managed to escape the bloodthirsty teenager's grasp. Aaron claimed that there were two extra people at the crime scene besides Damien, Jason, and Jesse that evening. Notably, despite knowing Jesse well, Aaron did not identify any of the convicted as members of the cult that he saw until after their arrest. Much of Aaron's stories were extremely outlandish and have been met with much skepticism from both supporters and the people who think the West Memphis Three are guilty. But did the police believe him? John Fogelman, the Arkansas state lawyer, claimed in the book Devil's Knot that the police officers frustrated him with how readily they swallowed Aaron's stories. But on June 9th, Officer Gitchell asked Aaron if he was telling the truth several times, before telling Aaron at the end of the interview that he knew the kid wouldn't make the story up, because the two were, quote, buddies. It's possible that the police thought it was a serious lead in the beginning, before Aaron's stories grew stranger and stranger. The final interview on record with Aaron was in January of 1994 with Don Bray. Aaron again went into lurid detail about the devil-worshipping cult that he saw in Robin Hood Hills. Aaron was never called to testify for the prosecution at trial, which was a bit of a surprise to his mother Vicky. She later said it was probably because he started implicating Mark Byers in the murders too, claiming to have seen him at the crime scene. In a 2004 interview, Aaron told the Arkansas Times newspaper that he was sure he had told the police about Mark Byers in his initial statements, despite it never being entered into official record. Vicky Hutchison, for her part, got involved in this case by deciding to play detective with the encouragement of Officer Don Bray. This was her explanation at trial. Hutchison: I thought I would play detective. Question: and in the course of that, and without saying what you had you heard some things about Damien Eccles? Hutchison: I heard a lot of things about Damien Eccles. Question: what did you do to try to learn more about this person? Hutchison: I had Jesse Miskelly Jr. introduce us. Vicky told the West Memphis Police Department on May 28th that she had attempted to cozy up to Damien in the past weeks, since she was sure that Damien and a satanic cult had been involved in the murders. She was the first person to make the connection between Jesse and Damien, alleging that both of them were involved in this cult. Damien had apparently taken her and Jesse to an orgy on May 19th, where they encountered cult members with paint on their faces. She told the police that Damien drove both her and Jesse there, though Damien and his family said that he did not have a driver's license. Additional fact: both Damien and Jason obtained their first driving licenses in 2011. This was after both being freed from prison, after serving 17 years incarcerated. At some point, Vicky would take part in a bugging operation with the West Memphis police to ensnare Damien into confessing, though the date of this is not clear. On June 2nd, 1993, she told the police that she had attempted to invite Damien to a party and that he had refused, so it would have had to have occurred before that date, but after May 27th when she gave her first statement. The recording was not documented on official record because, according to the West Memphis Police Department, it was inaudible. Was this official police procedure? I'd be keen to know if any American listeners who are aware could shed some light. They claimed in trial that they could not make out any of the words being spoken in the recording, and as such, thought it was unimportant. Vicky testified in Jesse's trial about going to the orgy, referred to as an esbat, with both Jesse and Damien. She was not called to testify in the Eccles-Baldwin trial, however. Much later, Vicky recanted her claims and began to claim that she had been in contact with the West Memphis police, in addition to Don Bray, well before her official statements. They had apparently put enormous pressure on her to investigate Damien, with Jerry Driver giving her multiple stories of how weird Damien was. They apparently convinced her that Damien was guilty. The police, in addition to Bray, also helped Vicky check out books in the library about Satanism. In a 2004 statement, Vicky alleged that the never-documented surveillance tape she provided was perfectly clear, but Damien didn't admit to anything, and thus the West Memphis police, upon hearing it, was unhappy with her. Vicky was then subjected to a 12-hour grilling session and forced to come up with her May 27th and 28th witness statements by the police, she alleges. This means that the tape recording session would have had to have been earlier than her first recorded statement to the police. Vicky said she was motivated to come forward because she felt so guilty about putting the three boys in jail. Oren has also recanted his statements since their convictions. It's almost certain and entirely reasonable to think that Vicky and Aaron Hutchison were probably not telling much of the truth in their initial statements, though it's entirely possible that Aaron really did see men in the woods before his friends were murdered. It's a little more difficult to figure out if Vicky was telling the truth with her horror stories about the West Memphis Police Department, however. Juvenile Probation Officer Jerry Driver. Damien's Satan-obsessed parole officer played a minimal role in the investigations and in the initial trial, though he was a major player in Damien's juvenile records, collected for Exhibit 500. Dr. Dale Griffiths, a rather controversial occult expert who testified for the prosecution, claimed to be in contact with Jerry Driver for about a year before the murders, talking into him on about five or six occasions about cult activity in the area. In June of 1993, Driver gave a statement about meeting with Officer Steve Jones, who did play a major role in the investigation, and going to Lakeshore Trailer Park to look for people involved in ritualistic animal sacrifices. Officer Driver mentioned in the report that he found a serrated knife and a lot of graffiti near the railroad tracks. One of Officer Driver's main statements to the police in December was about Damien and Jason's occult activity, an organization he claimed had around 7 to 10 members. Driver alleged that Damien had told him all about the cult and said Damien was introduced to it by an older woman, but that Damien refused to name or to talk about said woman. A few choice things that Damien allegedly told him was this. Damien always said he was interested in the occult. He just always denied being a devil worshipper. He always said he knew who did it in relation to the murders. He knew, he allegedly stated at one time, that he knew of a book in West Memphis called the Necronomicon. Also, this. During this same interview, Eccles was asked, what was the extent of the cult activities here in Crittenden County and the West Memphis area? He told the police that it was fairly extensive, that there was three or four groups in West Memphis itself. They were further along in their activities than Damien may or may not have been. By that he said he meant that they had reached the end of their animal sacrifice activities. So thus they were to receive power and that the next logical step would be the sacrifice of a human. Damien's girlfriend Dominie would also get into the action. The first thing she said was, quote, why should I not drink blood? Because my mother drinks blood. I have no clue if Officer Driver just made these details up, or if Damien and Domini were joking around with him. Damien did later claim that he was, quote, trying to yank the officer's chain. You can certainly begin to see why so many people in West Memphis were convinced that Damien had something to do with a cult. Someone was certainly going around propagating rumors, so to speak. The aftermath. The cult angle definitely became very prominent after the three were arrested, and this time it was obviously police-directed. A witness at Jesse's trial later said that she did not provide a crucial part of Jesse's alibi to the police at the time because they were only interested in asking her about the cult. After the arrest of the three teenagers, a significant portion of questions posed to their families and friends were about the defendants' religious beliefs. Police officers asked Damien's family repeatedly if he practiced witchcraft. His girlfriend was grilled about whether Damien drank blood. Jason's father had to confirm that his son did not attend meetings with Damien, and the police officers were very eager to talk with him about Damien wearing black. Only three people claimed to attend the same cult meetings as Damien, Jesse, and Jason. Their statements were notably taken after the three were arrested and not before. One was Jesse Miskelly himself, who identified 10 potential members, all of whom denied it, and claimed that the cult met on Wednesdays. Witness Ricky C., a 16-year-old, said that this cult consisted just of him, Damien, Jesse, and Jason, and would mention no special meeting days. Alvis B. identified 20 people in the cult, although most not by name, and he had an extremely hard time with everyone that he could identify by name, such as calling Damien Davian multiple times, and he also said that the cult met on Sundays. Despite the relative lack of teenagers actually admitting that they were in a cult that raped women, killed animals, and sacrificed kids to Satan, different newspapers published in West Memphis said that satanic cults were not just rumor, but cold hard fact. One newspaper announced in its headlines that the Satanism rumors surrounding the three arrested were no surprise to the neighborhood, even though a local who lived in Lakeshore Trailer Park had stated the rumors were nonsense and that no cult activity occurred in the area. An editorial urged the town's residents to take action against Satanism in their community, since the threat had become too big to ignore any longer in a flagrant attempt to whip up frenzy among the locals. Descriptions of the cult that Damien, Jesse, and Jason allegedly belonged to were not brought up much by the prosecution, who were somewhat curtailed by not being allowed to bring up aspects of the crime that were deemed too prejudicial. Going into too much detail about the cults when it did not relate to the motives of the convicted, or when it didn't corroborate Jesse's confessions, was not something the prosecution was allowed to do. There were also practical problems to the cult angle. Ricky C. was on a list to be called to testify by the prosecution, but since he also told the police that he saw Smurfs during these cult meetings, one can imagine the issues with putting him on the stand and what those were. To clarify, that was Smurfs, as in the little blue cartoon characters with the little white trousers. The prosecution did seem to downplay the cult's size and impact when it was brought up in trial. When asked about all the other alleged members denying it, the prosecution simply said that the three defendants seemed like a cult to him, and later said the cult in West Memphis probably consisted of only Damien and his groupies. The idea that there were Satanists lurking in every corner of the town would not be given much weight in court otherwise. Not a soul. The occult, more specifically Satanism, did play a large role in the Eccles-Baldwin trial. Perhaps the most commonly derided aspect of the prosecution's satanic angle is that they put occult expert Dr. Dale Griffiths up on the stand. I'll get into him a bit later. But Griffiths basically said that he felt the crime had, quote, trappings of the occult. Griffiths notably dodged the defense's question about whether he thought the murders were a satanic ritual or not. Some choice examples of why he thought this way was that the boys were spread open and tied up. The murder occurred during a full moon. The boys were put in the water, which is an element that is important in Wiccan rituals, and the murder occurred in a secluded area. The crime also occurred on May 5th, which was a week after two prominent occult holidays, Beltane and Walpurgisnacht. Several other aspects of the crime, such as the overkill aspect, were brought up only in the on-camera hearing and not in the trial itself, since Griffiths admitted that he did not know all of the details of the boy's injuries. The defense later forced Dr. Griffiths to admit that the boys could have been tied up for a sexual predator, that the water didn't necessarily have to be connected to the occult, and that if there were 13 different holidays in his occult calendar, and a crime occurring a week later meant it was satanic, then crimes committed in roughly 26 weeks of the year could be considered an occult killing. When he was pressed about the area being near houses and an interstate, Griffiths insisted that it seemed secluded to him. Other than Griffiths, the trial was perhaps a bit more measured than the popular portrayal. Denunciations of reading Stephen King books were mostly confined to a statement by Officer Ridge, who thought it was, quote, strange. I mean, I've read a hell of a lot of Stephen King books. I bet you have too. Never felt the urge to slaughter a human being, though. How about you? Liking horror books and movies were then brought up mainly by the defense and Damien's family, not by the prosecution, however. Metallica posters and black shirts were submitted as evidence, but the prosecution focused on them considerably less in court than Damien's writings, tattoos, and books he checked out of the library on the subject of the occult. One of the focal points at trial was the Book of Shadows, an occult book in Damien's possession that appeared to have multiple different spells and sections. Those range from harmless incantations to keep out worms and the creation of love potions to underlined parts that had to do with devil worship and blood. Damien claimed that the book was just about different religions, and the parts that were underlined had been underlined before he had received the book. They were library-owned books, after all. Other books Damien had checked out at the library were about Cotton Mather, a figure during the Salem witch trials, and about the history of magic. Damien's tattoos consisted of an Egyptian anchor symbol, a pentagram which he tattooed on his own chest, and an aged tattoo that had since faded where he inscribed the word evil on his knuckles. When he was asked why he tattooed the word evil on himself, Damien shrugged and said he thought it looked cool, making some sort of reference to Metallica as well. Damien also had a tattoo of a cross on his hand. The prosecution made some allusions to Damien's interest in the occult, based on these tattoos alone. A piece of Damien's writings were quoted in the prosecution's closing speech at trial. The prosecution alleged that the following written piece referred to Damien dabbling in both Satanism and Wicca, both evil and good. The writing in question read, quote, "In the middle. I want to be in the middle, in neither the black nor the white, in neither the wrong nor the right. To stand right on the line, to be able to go to either side with a moment's notice. I've always been in the black and in the wrong. I tried to get into the white, but I almost destroyed it because the black tried to follow me. This time, I won't let it. I will be in the middle." The only other part of Damien's writings that received equal attention would be a piece of paper where he wrote down the name of himself, Jason Baldwin, his son, and Aleister Crowley in a coded alphabet. The prosecution alleged he had written it in jail, though Damien was unsure. This document was not admitted into evidence since the prosecution had not submitted it beforehand, nor informed the defense about using it, and it was unclear about how it was procured in the first place. Most of the rest of Damien's notebooks were ordinary quotes and references to Metallica. There was a pentagram drawn on the cover of one that he claimed looked cool, and a satanic-looking poster that Damien claimed was drawn by his ex-girlfriend, Deanna. Jason's only connection to Satanism were, allegedly, his black t-shirts and friendship with Damien, something that his defense lawyer pointed out at trial. Witness statements agreed that Jesse pretty much had no interest in the occult, and the prosecution in trial didn't attempt to significantly argue that point. So, what was the point of all of this? Why even bring it up at Jason and Damien's trial? John Fogelman said this in the Arkansas State Prosecution closing argument. Quote, "The reason to present the occult stuff is to try to inflame you all and make you all so angry because it's something different." Well, no, not at all. When you looked at those pictures of what was done to those three little boys, could you understand it? Could you have any reason to understand why someone would do that to 3 8-year-old boys? Well, you've got 3 8-year-old boys killed that way. And then you got the defendants looking like choir boys during the trial, during jury selection. In fact, think back to jury selection when the defense was trying to say, well, as they sit here right now, what do you think about them? And either you or your fellow juror, you heard a fellow juror say, I think they look like typical kids. Well, think how hard it would be for you to conceive of typical teens doing what was done to these 3 8-year-old boys. And I think you'll understand why there was the need to put in this evidence. Fogelman claimed in his closing statement later that it did not matter if the crime was a satanic ritual, had satanic elements, or even if Satanism was just the motive. He felt that it had been proven in court that the occult was connected to the murder in some way. Part 2, the physical evidence. Just to be entirely clear, I am not going to be providing links or posting any of the images of the children post-mortem. They're out there, and they are pretty gruesome and distressing. If you choose to seek them out, that's entirely your decision. The next section contains graphic description of injuries to the children. Please use your discretion. There is frustratingly not a lot of physical evidence associated with the case. The water washed away most solid DNA evidence, and there's really not one piece of physical evidence pointing to any one person in particular. One of the most contentious slivers of evidence will be covered later. But for now, I'm just going to run through some key pieces used against the West Memphis Three, both at trial and after, as well as some other notable oddities. Wax evidence. Blue candle wax was found on the shirt of a victim. The same color of wax was found on a book of Damien's, and a blue candle would be photographed in Dominique Tier's trailer. Lisa Sakovitius, an expert witness for the prosecution, told John Fogelman that the evidence seized did not match anything found at the crime scene. Fogelman, however, made the connection during his closing statement. Fiber evidence. As the witnesses repeatedly pointed out, there's no such thing as matching fiber evidence. You can say that fibers are microscopically similar, but you cannot say with any sort of authority which piece of clothing they came from, or that they match certain pieces of clothing. I think this is a common misconception, particularly in legal and forensic terms. We just aren't that advanced, despite the perception. With that being said, fibers would be one of the linchpins of this trial, because of course they would be. One of the strongest physical pieces of evidence against the West Memphis Three was a red rayon fiber retrieved from one of the victim's shirts. Sakovitius said that rayon fibers were much less common than cotton or polyester, and the defense witness, Charles Lynch, agreed. With that statement, there were microscopic similarities found between the fiber and a bathrobe that belonged to Jason's mother. The prosecution assured the jury that no one was attempting to argue that Jason was wearing a bathrobe during the murders, and that this probably came from secondary transfer at home. The defense witness, Charles Lynch, disputed Sakovicius's findings, highlighting the differences in shape and color. The prosecution pointed out to him that Sakovicius had flattened one end of the fiber, accounting for the discrepancy in the shape and possibly in the color. He claimed that this did not change his opinion. He also claimed that he could not flatten the fiber and testified that the fibers found in the bathrobe were round, differing from the fiber that he had looked at. The prosecution called another witness from the Arkansas Crime Lab. This witness backed up what Sakovitius found, saying that the fiber could be flattened easily, and also claiming that rayon fibers were generally not round. He was not able to say that the fiber had come from the bathrobe, just that they had microscopic similarities. The other main fibers argued at trial were a green polyester and a green cotton fiber found on the victims, which matched a shirt belonging to Damien. This was later found inconclusive with further testing done after conviction. Most of the fibers were retested by experts hired by Jason Baldwin's defense attorneys. They were found to not be the microscopic matches they had appeared to be back in 1994. The experts attacked Sakovitius' expertise and findings, claiming that she had a weak knowledge of hair and fibers. the red rayon fiber, which was so important during trial, would never be retested. There is substantial more information regarding the fibers found and tested at trial and since on Callahan. Hair evidence. Many hairs were recovered from the crime scene, most of which belonged to the victims. Later testing also found that some hairs recovered belonged to canines or felines. Stevie Branch owned a dog, and it's possible that many of the animal hairs found on the victims could have been either from secondary transfer or potentially from animal predation, as experts for the defense argued in post-conviction hearings. Some of the hairs, however, did not come from either the victims or from domestic cats or dogs. A now infamous human hair was recovered from Michael Moore's body. It was located around the ligature binding his hands and feet together. Another hair was found on his Cub Scout cap. One hair, which was African American in origin, was found in the white sheet used to transport Chris Byers during the medical examination, and another that did not belong to either the defendants, the victims, or any popular suspects, was also found in his ligatures. A dyed hair was found on the sheet used to cover Stevie Branch. Another hair was found on a tree stump nearby. Not all of the hair found on the victims was retested by the defense in the 2000s when further DNA analysis took place. Though similarities between some of the hairs and the convicted were found during early testing, retesting, which was asked for by the defense, would later exclude the West Memphis Three. One particular hair that matched with 7% of the population of West Memphis, including a friend of Terry Hobbs by the name of David Jacoby, had striking similarities to much of Damien Eccles' DNA, though Damien was a single nucleotide distant from the friend and could be ruled out as belonging to Eccles. It's worth noting that the hair found in the ligature used to tie Michael Moore matched exactly to the DNA of Terry Hobbs, who was Stevie Branch's stepfather. Knots and shoelace evidence. Sakovicius testified that three different knots were found on the body of the victims. Michael Moore was tied with a square knot on his left side. He had a series of three half hitches on his right side, followed by a series of four half hitches. Stevie Branch had three half hitches on his left side and a half hitch with a figure eight knot on the right wrist and three half hitches with an extra loop around the leg on his right ankle. Chris Byers had two half hitches on all of his bindings. John Douglas claimed that this could be explained by the perpetrators forcing the victims to tie each other up, and the defense claimed that it could be one perpetrator alternating his knots. It's worth adding that all of the knots are considered to be simple and easy to perform. The defense would argue that most people have a go-to knot that they commonly use, and it's not usual for people to use multiple knots in any one situation. The way the victims were tied had some significance, with veterans being focused on during the investigation. It's debatable about whether the tying was a simple matter of practicality to control three victims, some sort of method of transport so they could be carried, or whether it was proof of some sort of profession like working in a slaughterhouse or hunting. The FBI felt it was most certainly the latter. There is also some suggestion that Christopher Byers was tied either after unconsciousness or death, since unlike Moore and Branch, he did not have any defense or struggle wounds on his wrists or ankles. This could potentially complicate the scenario wherein each victim was forced to tie each other up. Would Moore and Branch fight back against their friends? Was Byers tied up first in this scenario? It's unclear. The laces were another thorny issue. One of the shoes found had its shoelace still intact, while the other shoelaces would all be missing from the shoes recovered. Chris and Stevie were tied on the left with a white shoelace and on the right with a black shoelace. Michael was tied with either a black shoelace or a piece of string. It was implied by Lisa Sakovicius and Damien Eccles' defense team that the ligament used to tie Michael Moore up was cut in half. Several different websites and independent research organizations have also claimed that the ligature used to tie Michael Moore was 60 inches long, though I've been unable to find corroboration of this on Callahan or any other original data source. A popular theory is that this lace used to bind Michael Moore came from the killer or killers themselves and not from the victim's shoelaces. What shoes the boys were wearing and where exactly the shoelaces came from is still hotly debated. There was a black Cougar-branded shoe, black sneakers and white tennis shoes recovered. These shoes were never matched up to the victims individually, nor were the shoelaces compared with each other or with any shoelaces found at any of the suspects' home. The families of the victims were not even asked if they were their children's shoes. It was just assumed. While you can argue that this may be acceptable, do you think that a case like this should be entirely thorough and by the book? The DNA on pendant evidence. One piece of physical evidence that was not introduced at trial was a pendant. It was seized from Damien's residence at the time of arrest, but Jason had also been photographed wearing it. Two spots of blood were found on the pendant. When the pendant and the spots of blood on it were analyzed, the DNA was consistent with 11% of the population. A blood type similar to Damien, Jason and one of the three victims was found on the necklace. It was never submitted for retesting by the defense. A more accurate analysis could be achieved by today's standards, but no request for retesting or analysis has come from either side. DNA mixed with Stevie Branch. A test in 2007 found that DNA mixed in with Stevie Branch on his ligatures was similar to Damien Eccles, though not the exact same. This was never tested any further, so it appears that we'll never truly know how close the match actually is. DNA matching Michael Moore and Jesse Miskelly. A shirt belonging to Jesse Miskelly was obtained with blood on it. The blood found matched up with both Jesse and Michael Moore's blood, since they shared the same blood type. While the odds are good that it was Jesse's blood, it is an odd coincidence that Jesse claimed to have been responsible for Michael Moore's injuries, and also had blood that may have been consistent with Moore on him. I absolutely don't think this was a game plan by Jesse, given his IQ. Further, when we are saying the blood matches, due to 1993-era science, all we are actually saying is that it's a blood group match. Whilst worth testing, I would imagine the odds of it being Jesse's blood are fairly high. The Evan Williams bottle. The only piece of physical evidence that corroborated any part of Jesse's confessions was found after Jesse's trial and was not used as evidence in his trial, or the Eccles-Baldwin trial. In Jesse's February 1994 confession to his lawyers, Miss Kelly alleged that he smashed a whiskey bottle on his way back from the crime scene under an overpass. Both the defense and the prosecution found the head of such a bottle after getting in their cars and searching for it. They went to the grocery store to confirm that the head belonged to the same brand Jesse alleged he had drunk that night. Now, this was over a year after the crimes in an area with debris, glass, litter, and bracken. It may have been the same smashed bottle by Jesse, if he was telling the truth. It's also, equally as unlikely, mathematically speaking, of just being another similar smashed bottle in the same area. Initials, ME, being carved on a tree near the crime scene. One interesting piece found near the crime scene was something described as a fresh carving by the police on a tree near to where the victims' bodies were found. You can look at pictures of the carving over on Callahan. It was briefly brought up in trial when the defense asked Officer Ridge about it. They pointed out that the initials did not really match up with Damien's, since Damien's birth name was Michael Hutchison, though presumably the ME could have been for Michael Eccles as well, though Damien never referred to himself as Michael Eccles, nor did anyone else. Shoe prints. One frustrating aspect of the case is that both shoe prints and fingerprints not belonging to the victims were found at the scene. There were two different tennis shoe prints that had plaster casts made out of them, but not enough ridge characteristics to match it up to anyone. A profile made after conviction also theorized that the back of Stevie's head may have been injured with a shoe as well, leaving some sort of compression. Another unidentified pattern compression abrasion can be found on the back of Steve Branch's head. Upon close examination, this pattern injury is consistent with compression made from footwear. Possible fingerprint impressions were found in the mud, but were not able to be compared to any of the suspects, and no match for them was ever found. Injuries to the victims. The main wounds that the victim sustained were to their head, where they suffered multiple fractures, contusions, and abrasions. The medical examiner believed two different types of blunt objects caused the trauma, each with a different width. He was unable to pinpoint exactly what those objects could have been, though the prosecution alleged that it may have been sticks, wooden boards, or even common household objects. Michael Moore had 63 specified injuries, Christopher Byers had 62, and Stevie Branch had 21. In addition to trauma to the head, the boys' bodies were covered in lacerations, scratches, bruises, and trauma. Christopher Byers' penis was degloved, if not entirely castrated, and the side of Stevie's face was gouged with half-moon-shaped wounds, in addition to other strange patterns. There were also injuries and bruises to the three boys' ears. The ultimate cause of death for Christopher Byers was initially ruled as multiple injuries, while Michael and Stevie had died from both their wounds and of drowning. The murder weapon. Though most of the injuries to the boys were abrasions and contusions, which could have been caused by a number of objects. Much of the focus during trial and beyond was on a possible knife being used to deglove Chris Byers' penis, to wound Stevie Branch's face, and to cause lacerations to the boys. The murder weapon that the prosecution alleged was wielded at the crime scene was a knife which was located in the lake behind Jason Baldwin's trailer. It was found by a diving team in November of 1993. The prosecution claimed that it was thrown from Jason's fishing pier since it was 47 feet away from the pier and would have had to be thrown 100 feet from the nearest alternative bank. The blade was 9 inches long with a 5-inch black handle, a seemingly obscene item for a teenage boy to own. A knife manufacturer testified that these sort of knives had compasses on the ends of them and that they were distributed from 1985 to 1987, though he did call the knife, quote, generic. Medical examiner Dr. Peretti said that the serrated markings on the boys' bodies matched the serrated knife edge. Deanna Holcomb, who was Damien's ex-girlfriend, claimed that she saw Damien with a similar knife in 1992. Dennis D., the boyfriend of Jason's mother, gave a statement where he thought Jason may have had a similar knife as well, but seemed confused about whether he had actually seen it, or just heard about it from Jason or Jason's mother. The defense attacked pretty hard regarding this knife at trial. There was no blood, no fingerprints, and nothing reliable to connect it to the crime scene, or Eccles, or Baldwin. Jesse said in his confession that Jason carried a 6-inch long folding knife around with him. Eccles claimed that a knife he owned was similar but with a different color handle. He also claimed that he got rid of his knife collection after leaving Oregon. Damien's mother said that Damien's biological father had sold the knife collection off. She was unable to produce a receipt or hard evidence of this. The prosecution wasn't able to specifically match up the wounds to the knife due to the unpredictability of skin elasticity, so it couldn't be guaranteed that the knife made the wounds on the boys' bodies at all. They were able to say that it seemed consistent with the knife, but also that many knives of similar size and serration could probably cause the same type of wound patterns. Here is a trial transcript discussing the knife. Quote, Ford. So, what you're saying is, based on the elasticity of skin, just about any serrated edge could cause it, couldn't it? Dr. Peretti. Well, one with a very fine serration, I think you can rule out a very, very fine serration, but most serrated knives, depending on the position of the deceased, the elasticity of the skin can cause those type of serrated. Ford. So, most serrated knives could cause this injury. Most serrated knives. Dr. Peretti, no, I think we can rule out a butter knife, okay, a serrated butter knife. After trial, Jason's mother and other witnesses claimed that if the knife did belong to Jason, then it was thrown into the lake months prior to the murders. Sam D., a neighbor who lived in Lakeshore Trailer Park, signed an affidavit claiming he had seen Jason's mother throw the knife into the water before the murders, and he testified to this in Jason's Rule 37 hearing in 2009. Garrett S., a friend of Jason's, and Dominie Tier would say the exact same thing. The diving team that retrieved the knife also admitted at trial that they did not look through other sections of the lake and that they found an incredible amount of debris located behind the fishing pier, implying that this was a popular dumping spot. They did not knock door-to-door at Lakeshore Trailer Park to ask if anyone had lost or dumped a knife, nor did they attempt to make sure that the knife actually belonged to Jason. It was simply attributed to him by the prosecution and assumed to have been his due to the proximity to his home. Animal-human predation versus knife wounds. Post-conviction. The West Memphis 3's legal team began to fight much of the claims that Dr. Peretti had made on the stand. They claimed that the knife wounds attributed to the boys were actually the results of potential human or animal bite marks. The prosecution fired back with its own arguments. Here is a brief outline of what each side had to say. The prosecution argument. The basic argument of the prosecution was that many of the wound patterns are consistent with a serrated knife, which medical expert Dr. Frank Peretti testified to, both at trial and consistently after. Peretti consistently claimed that the hemorrhage on the boys' wounds, like the penis degloving, showed that they had been committed ante-mortem, not after. Christopher Byers was paler than the other two boys, suggesting that he bled to death, and he also didn't have the defense wounds when tied up, suggesting that he had lapsed into unconsciousness or had died before he was placed in the water. The half-moon wounds on Stevie Branch's face match up with similar gouging wounds made from serrated knives. There were many marks on the boys' bodies that also looked like consistent, even patterns made from a knife. Michael Moore had cuts on his hands that looked like defensive knife wounds. Ligatures used to tie up the boys were also suggested by both Sakevicius and by Damien Eccles' defense team to be cut in half, which would have to be done with a sharp instrument. Different experts, like Dr. William Stirner, also agreed with the medical examiner that there was no animal predation and that the contested wounds to the victims had been caused by a serrated knife. Two experts in knife wounds had this to say in regards to wounds on the children's faces. Expert 1. I believe the injury to the left forehead and upper lid of the left eye were produced by the knife recovered, or one similar. I also sent the photos of the injuries and the knife to another for evaluation, and he agrees. Have fun with this, and thank you for sending it to me. Homer. Expert 2. Bingo. The circular mark sure looks like the butt of the survival knife. The measurements fit. The diameter of the injury is 30 millimeters, and the diameter of the prominent circular area of the butt of the knife is 29.8 millimeters. The three lacerations under the eyebrow look like they were made by the serrations on the backside of the knife. The measurements also fit here. The lacerations measure 11.2 millimeters between them, and the serrated points on the knife vary between 11.1 and 11.4 millimeters. Of course, the photo with the wooden ruler depicting these serrations is blurry, but I can still measure them. The prosecution also attacked the defense's animal and human predation claims. The defense had at first argued that some of the wounds, in particular the one to Stevie's face, had been caused by a human, before switching and arguing that animals had done it. The defense claimed the reason for the switch was receiving updated information and analysis from a new expert. The prosecution argued in Damien's Rule 37 hearing in 1998 that there was no reason to think there was human bite marks on the boys. The same argument would be waged in Jason and Jesse's Rule 37 hearings in the 2000s. During these hearings, Dr. Peretti claimed that turtles or other animals would not have left the precise wounds which were found on the bodies. Two of the children also died of drowning, meaning that the bodies probably couldn't have been left out in the open for long, thus giving time for land mammals to prey upon them while unconscious. Although, it has to be said, the defense didn't argue that all the animal wounds were ante-mortem. The defense argument. Damien, Jason, and Jesse's newfound fame following their convictions meant that they had access to much more resources post-conviction than they did during their trial. They assembled an impressive group of experts to claim that many of the wounds on the boys couldn't have been caused by a knife. In 1998, Brent Turvey reported on possible human bite marks and was backed up by Dr. Thomas David in Damien's Rule 37 hearing, who believed that the mark on Stevie's face, which non-supporters ascribed to the butt of a compass knife, was from human bite marks. In the documentary Paradise Lost 2, much was made out of Mark Byers' teeth being pulled, which the filmmakers found suspicious. Byers had chosen to remove all of his teeth shortly after the crimes and could not come up with a consistent or believable reason as to why he did this. There is agreement from certain corners that the mark on Stevie's face couldn't have been caused by a compass knife. Some arguments on popular West Memphis 3 forums state that the indentation on Stevie Branch's face didn't make sense with being hit with the butt of a knife. One person proposed that it could have been caused by a screwdriver, which was found at the crime scene, though rarely discussed. Normally, I wouldn't entertain including comments from internet sleuths, but due to the substantial amounts of work and funds poured into this case by independent parties, certain independent groups and individuals are considered highly credible researchers in regards to this specific case. Numerous experts testified to animal predation later in the 2000s. Here are some opinions of Dr. Janice Oppoven, one of the United States' leading forensic pathologists. Dr. Werner Spitz, another leading U.S. forensic pathologist who gave evidence in the investigation into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., the trial of O.J. Simpson, and the investigation into the death of John Bennett Ramsey, and also of Terry Haddix, another reputable forensic pathologist with more than 30 years' experience and expertise. Dr. Janice Oppoven. She believed it was possible Christopher Byers drowned. She thought his penis was gnawed upon by an animal post-mortem, and there was biting, chewing, and clawing of the thigh area from animals. The ears were chewed and pulled upon by an animal, and the injuries to the face could have been done by an animal, likely snapping turtles, which were in large numbers in the bayou where the bodies were found. Dr. Werner Spitz. He thought that all three victims were alive when placed into the water due to the bloody foam in their throats. There were apparently multiple bites and claw marks by animals, including aquatic ones. The hemorrhage under the skin apparently does not contradict this analysis, according to Spitz. He mentioned large, carnivorous animals in 2007 and was a proponent of the theory that the boys were shaken around by large animals like dogs, focusing on paw marks on the bodies. Dr. Terry Haddix. This expert thought that the injuries on Michael Moore and the injuries on Christopher Byers' buttocks were consistent with dragging. She did not see the hemorrhage from photographs. She also thought it was possible that Byers' face was subject to animal predation. She claimed that the injuries on genital areas do appear to have hemorrhage, but also do not follow the cleanly incised edges of a knife. The photos do not show hemorrhage of a certain injury of the thigh, she stated. Further experts such as Dr. Neil Haskell, PhD in pathology. He believed that some of the wounds could have been created by freshwater fish and submitted a signed affidavit stating so. Dr. Richard Souviron. Another independent forensic pathology expert stated that all three bodies were alive when placed into the water. Branch's facial injuries are consistent with aquatic activity. The genital and thigh mutilation of Christopher Byers was post-mortem and common with animal predation. Dr. Michael Baden. A former medical examiner from San Antonio, Texas, thought after examining the evidence that all three died of drowning. The so-called knife wounds were the result of animal predation, while the children were rendered unconscious by blows to their head. Baden did not see hemorrhage or penetrating wounds on Branch's face and believed that the knife wounds on the children's heads were the result of blunt force trauma. Some alleged knife wounds also could have been from rubbing up in the water. Baden also did not see hemorrhage in the genital wounds of Christopher Byers, which he believes was inflicted post-mortem. He had never seen ear or mouth injuries from children forced to perform oral sex. For clarity, Each and all of these experts conducted their examinations and research of the bodies independently, with no knowledge of the case beforehand and no knowledge of other experts' opinions or findings. The defense attacked the medical examiner's original findings, arguing that Dr. Peretti was not board certified at the time and that he had been a tool of the prosecution. The board certification element of that argument is true and accurate. I'm unable to comment on the accuracy of the comment regarding Peretti being a tool of the prosecution. In the Rule 37 hearing, one of Jason Baldwin's lawyers claimed that Dr. Peretti had told him some of the wounds ascribed to the knife could have been caused by turtles, but the lawyer never brought it up later in the trial because he thought it was irrelevant. Peretti didn't deny this. One of the biggest arguments made by the supporters on the West Memphis 3 is that the wounds on the victims do not match up with the prosecution's arguments. If three bloodthirsty teens had access to a big knife, why is it that there are not big stab marks on the victims or any slashes to their bodies, they argue? Rather, the knife seems to have been used to mostly scrape and bludgeon the boys, with Christopher's degloving and Stevie's gouging wounds being aberrations. One comment from a supporter was that using the knife in this way to commit a murder is like having a loaded gun and trying to stab someone with it. Insect evidence. One offshot during the animal predation saga was a slight focus on insects. An expert, Dr. Neil Haskell, claimed that fly larvae found in the eyes and nostrils of the victims could be used as evidence against the argument that the boys were killed at the crime scene. The insects would not have deposited eggs in or on a living person, and water is a barrier to colonization. He believed that it's possible the eggs could have hatched at the time the boys' bodies were found, meaning that the flies had colonized the bodies 12 to 16 hours beforehand. A different expert named Leo M. Goff disagreed with Dr. Haskell. He thought Haskell did not have the right information to determine when the insects would have colonized the boys. He also thought, had the eggs been laid in the boys prior to being placed in the water, they would have been washed away. Finally, he pointed out that the boys had been laying out after being retrieved from the ditch by the West Memphis police, which could be enough time for larvae to be laid, depending on the species, of course. Stick weapon evidence. One of the causes of trauma to the head was theorized to be from wooden sticks. Three different sticks were taken into evidence. One, Exhibit E17, was taken immediately after the murders, due to it having some unique carvings. The other two were obtained on July 1st. At trial, the West Memphis police claimed that they had taken the sticks into evidence after Jesse Miss Kelly's confession, though the defense pointed out that if that was the case, then this had taken them more than a month to do. Sticks are first mentioned as a murder weapon by the police, though it is elaborated on by Jesse. Here is the transcript. Detective Gary Gitchell, did you ever use or did anyone use a stick to hit the boys with? Jesse Miss Kelly. Damien had kind of a big old stick when he hit that first one, after he hit him with his fist and knocked him down and got him a big old stick and hit him. Gitchell, what did the stick look like? I mean, was it like a big log like that, or was it a stick? Miss Kelly, I would say it was about that big around. I would say about that long. Gitchell, okay. Detective Bryn Ridge, about the size of a baseball bat, maybe just a little bit bigger around? The two sticks taken into evidence in July were Exhibits E-138 and E-139. E-138 appeared to have just been a stick found near the crime scene, but E-139 was apparently the same stick that had been used to jam down some of the children's clothing into the mud. The defense asked Detective Bryn Ridge why he had not submitted it into evidence sooner, and he told them that he had not considered it important until after Jesse's confession. They also asked if he made some sort of markings to determine that it was the same stick that he had found on May 5th, and he admitted that he had not. One thing brought up in trial was that the exhibit, E17 stick, had amino acid on it, indicating it may have been handled by a human. The expert who testified this also admitted that this acid could have been from the water, however. No fingerprints on the sticks were ever found. Three weapons. Much like the three knots, this was alluded to by the prosecution several times. They pointed out the two different forms of trauma to the head, as well as the knife that they claimed was used in the murders. There was some reference to Jesse testifying to three separate weapons being used in his confessions, which wasn't quite the case, since in the initial one, he only makes reference to a knife and a stick that Damien used to beat the victims and to choke Christopher Byers. Part 3. The Trial. The trials for the three convicted were split into two separate trials. Jesse Miss Kelly was tried first and alone. Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin were tried second and together. Both were held in early 1994. While the severance between Jesse and Damien Jason was granted, Jason Baldwin's attorneys were unsuccessful in pushing for a divided trial. They pleaded with Judge Burnett to give Jason another trial due to the possibility of an antagonistic defense between the two defendants. Judge Burnett refused, insisting throughout the trial that there was no need for the two to be separated. That was only the beginning of a contentious 1994 for the trial circuit in Arkansas. Jesse's trial centered mainly around his confessions. The defense first tried to have him declared mentally unfit, which was denied, since his IQ was above 60. They then tried to argue that Jesse's confessions were coerced, something that was hampered by the judge. He did not allow them to have any of their experts outright state that opinion. The judge's reasoning was that he didn't want two experts battling over stated opinions, though he allowed the expert to give circumstances that would have led to a false confession and for the defense to argue that Jesse met them. One of Jesse's lawyers, Dan Stidham, became a passionate supporter long after Jesse was convicted. He claimed later that he was paid $19 an hour and that he could not hire the experts he wanted during trial because to have them paid for, he would have had to submit them to a judge and let the prosecution know beforehand who he was planning to put on the stand. He was paid for trial expenses, but there was a $1,000 fee cap, which Judge Burnett admittedly did exceed when paying Stidham. Damien and Jason's trial was even more unusual. The prosecution chose to put an occult expert, Dale Griffiths, on the stand, who admitted during a dramatic trial moment that his degree was from an online mail-order degree outlet. Griffiths further admitted when challenged that he took no classes for his degree and simply paid for the certificate to be printed and mailed to him. The judge ruled that due to his experience in the field, his testimony would be admissible anyway. The defense frequently seemed at odds. Jason Baldwin later said in his Rule 37 hearing that he felt that his lawyers thought Damien was guilty. His lawyers did not make use of Eccles' private investigator, Ron Lacks, nor did they collaborate much with the Eccles' defense team, causing a disjointed approach that ultimately benefited the prosecution. Baldwin was not put on the stand, and his team refused to present an alibi for him, feeling it would, quote, do more harm than good. They later said that their strategy was mostly to let the prosecution keep the heat on Damien. One of Jason's lawyers also admitted that the medical examiner had told him that he thought some of the injuries to the boys could have been done by turtles. But the lawyer did not bring it up in trial because he felt it was irrelevant to the innocence of his client, though would become hugely important in the years following their convictions. Not being paid enough was also a complaint during the Rule 37 hearings for Damien and Jason. Val Price, one of Damien's attorneys, said he was paid $33 an hour, while the going rate for death penalty cases is much higher. Jason Baldwin was handicapped in many ways by his joint trial with Damien. There was comparatively much less evidence against him than either of his two alleged conspirators. The prosecution seemed to realize that too. The book Devil's Knot details how Jason was offered a plea deal if he testified against Damien. They initially offered a deal of 40 years, which would allow for parole, and then came back with a 20-year deal. Jason could have potentially been out of jail in 10 years. Curiously, Jason refused, naively believing that he could not be found guilty if he hadn't committed the crimes, When he was eventually sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole, Jason was asked by Judge Burnett if he had any reason why the sentence shouldn't be imposed. He responded as this. The court. Do either of you have any legal reason to show the court or to give the court as to why a sentence should not be imposed? Mr. Eccles? Eccles. No, sir. The court. Mr. Baldwin? Baldwin. Because I'm innocent. The court. Pardon? Baldwin. Because I'm innocent. There were a lot of allegations about the jury, particularly in the Eccles-Baldwin trial. Jesse's trial and the Eccles-Baldwin joint trial were moved from the town of West Memphis so as to find an impartial jury. Jesse's trial was held in Clay County, while the Eccles-Baldwin trial took place in Jonesboro, a relatively liberal locale in Arkansas. Whether the jury was actually impartial was hotly contested after conviction. One of the most damaging claims was that of foreman misconduct. Affidavits came after trial claiming that the foreman of the Eccles-Baldwin trial had made up his mind that the two were guilty before the trial even began and actively campaigned to get other jurors to convict them with him. There were also allegations that the jury took Jesse's confessions into consideration, despite it not being submitted into evidence. Quote, despite being asked on the voir dire or preliminary jury examination what they had read or heard about the killings of the three victims, no juror revealed that they were aware of the fact that Miss Kelly had given a statement or of the contents of that statement. It is now clear, however, that at least three jurors, 4, 6, and 7, knew of Miss Kelly's confession, and that juror 4, the foreman, was thoroughly familiar with many of its details, including the fact that Miss Kelly had accused Eccles and Baldwin of killing the youngsters. This was taken from the October 2007 court filing by the Eccles defense team. Even the judge made a remark of this nature, admitting that everyone had heard about Jesse's confessions prior to the trial. Quite astonishing. John Mark Byers. The stepfather of victim Christopher Byers, named John Mark Byers, was arguably the star of the first Paradise Lost documentary, where he acted out in various ways and played to the cameras enormously. One of the most enduring scenes from the film was when he shot pumpkins alongside the father of Michael Moore, pretending that he was really aiming at the defendants. Filled with fire and brimstone, he threatened both the convicted and their families. In an interview with the West Memphis Police on May 19, 1993, he told them he, quote, could squeeze the life out of the animal that committed the murders. This would come back to bite him when he began to gain traction as a suspect among many supporters. Byers had a long criminal history. According to Devil's Knot, he had threatened his parents at age 17 with a butcher's knife. His ex-wife also alleged that he abused her and their children, and he was put on probation for threatening her in 1987. His stepson Ryan stated recently that Byers was an awful stepfather, violent, and abused him and his younger brother Christopher regularly. He was a compulsive drug user. After the murders, his neighbors took out a restraining order against him for threatening their child. There were also various drug and petty theft convictions on his record. Byers was also investigated in March 1996, after his wife Melissa died of unknown causes while asleep in bed next to him. No charges would be brought against him, however. Devil's Knot uncovered information that Byers had worked for the police as a drug informant in the late 1980s and early 1990s. In the late 1990s, he served prison time for attempting to sell drugs to an undercover police officer, where he joined a gang that was an offshoot of a violent white supremacist group. Byers admittedly was angry at Christopher on the day he disappeared, whipping him with a belt buckle for not following directions and skateboarding down the street. Supporters alleged that this could be a motive for killing the boys, and did kind of make some sort of sense, since Chris had received the most vicious wounds out of any of the victims. Byers also had a knife that had blood on it, consistent with both his and Christopher's blood type. This was brought up in trial, where the medical examiner admitted that the knife could have caused some of the injuries to the boys, though he did not believe the serration pattern was consistent with all of them. But then neither was the knife supposedly owned by Jason Baldwin. Much suspicion was also cast on Byers for getting all of his teeth pulled and replacing them with dentures, especially since some supporters in the early 2000s believed some wounds on Stevie Branch's face could have been caused by human bite marks. Byers alleged that he needed them replaced after taking epilepsy medication, which could cause dry mouth but didn't generally lead to teeth rotting. This story changed on a number of occasions. Byers told other stories regarding his teeth, such as that he had gotten them knocked out in a bar fight, further fueling suspicion. This all culminated in the documentary Paradise Lost 2, which cast Byers as a serious suspect and portrayed him as a very suspicious individual. Supporters of the West Memphis 3 began to back off Byers, however, when new DNA evidence implicated another stepfather in the crimes, and he is no longer considered a serious suspect among many people who follow the case. Although, to be clear, this doesn't excuse all of his numerous other issues. What helps Byers is that, all things considered, he had a fairly tight alibi for the night the children were murdered. Byers was searching from the crucial 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. period for his stepson, something that was corroborated by his family, police officers, and other members of the town, and multiple eyewitnesses. Byers himself came to believe that the West Memphis Three are innocent. In Paradise Lost 3, Damien Eccles apologized to Byers for pointing fingers at him, writing a letter to him from death row. Eccles stated that he was wrong to accuse him of the crimes with no evidence to support his accusations, something that many in the town of West Memphis had done to him. John Mark Byers died in June 2020. Mr. Bojangles, a person referred to as Mr. Bojangles, is one of the most mysterious and mythical elements of the case. At roughly 8:30 p.m. on May 5th, Officer Regina Meeks responded to a disturbance call at a Bojangles fast food restaurant, located about 3/4 of a mile away from the crime scene on Missouri Street. The manager informed police that several restaurant customers, including himself, had witnessed a black man, disoriented, wearing an arm cast or brace, and covered in blood, making his way into the restaurant restroom, where he left behind sunglasses. He had smeared or deposited a large amount of his blood over the facility's walls, faucets, and toilet cubicle, and used a large amount of toilet paper which he seemed to have thrown around the facility. The sunglasses had been flushed in the toilet, though remained in the toilet bowl. The man was still in the restroom when the manager, named as Amati King, entered and was sat on the toilet seat with his head in his hands. King briefly spoke to the man to ensure he was okay, but the man had very little to say. The man had left the scene by the time the police had arrived at the restaurant, however. After searching outside for a few minutes, though never actually entering the restaurant, Officer Meeks left the scene at 8:50 p.m. to respond to another call. The next day, the manager was interviewed by police, and blood samples, in addition to the sunglasses, were taken by the West Memphis police. This story became legend and morphed over time as Mr. Bojangles was introduced at the trial. The manager claimed on the stand to have seen him around 9:30 p.m., contradicting police reports. The police reports were the correct version, matched against the time the call came in to police dispatch. The restaurant manager's story changed even more at trial. Black boots became muddy boots, for example. The police admitted that they lost the blood samples which they took from the scene and never attempted to trace where the sunglasses either came from or subsequently went. This was especially egregious considering an African-American hair was later found on the body of Christopher Byers and was never matched to any of the other suspects. The defense also pointed out during trial the proximity of the crime scene to the restaurant. Independent investigator Bob Ruff recently conducted an experiment to ascertain if a person could follow the bayou the distance to the restaurant and make it there within the tight time frame required for Mr. Bojangles to be a viable suspect. Whilst Ruff ultimately succeeded in the test, he also raised a valid point. Why would a killer go to all the trouble of hiding their presence and traveling secretly down the bayou to avoid detection, only to then walk into a public and busy restaurant just after the crimes? Fair. The stepfather of Stevie Branch, Terry Hobbs stated in a 2007 statement to the police that he saw a black homeless man walking from an area that appeared to be Robin Hood Hills in the direction of the railroad tracks early on the morning of May 6th. Both John Mark Byers and Pam Hobbs have claimed to have never have heard about this sighting before from Terry Hobbs. There are also statements about a, quote, bum who lived under the overpass by several different witnesses. To this day, Mr. Bojangles has never been conclusively identified. His status as an actual suspect has been debated over the years. For one thing, it would have taken him at least 30 minutes to have gone from the crime scene to the restaurant, something that probably would have taken longer in his disoriented state. For another, he was supposedly bleeding heavily, which contrasted with the lack of blood found at the crime scene or indeed any other location close by. Finally, with his arm in a cast or brace and his slim frame, he probably would have had a hard time subduing and controlling all three of the victims by himself. No one has ever stepped forward to identify themselves, and two people were ultimately investigated and dismissed as the possible true identity of the Bojangles man. One potential suspect claimed to have a different arm brace, and the other person said that he stopped wearing his brace around Thanksgiving of 1992. Why Mr. Bojangles fled from the scene and never sought any assistance from authorities is probably just another question about this case that will never be answered. Alternate suspects. Terry Hobbs. Hobbs is perhaps the most publicized and well-known suspect that this case has, besides, of course, the West Memphis three teenagers, now men, themselves. Terry Hobbs was Stevie Branch's stepfather, as I mentioned previously. He had formerly worked in a slaughterhouse and he resided in West Memphis in 1993 with his wife Pam, his stepson Stevie, and his daughter Amanda. He would not be interviewed or investigated by police until 2007, when retesting of the hairs from the crime scene found one that was consistent with his DNA, and another that could be matched to his best friend and person who Hobbs was seen with on the night of the murders, David Jacoby. The hair that was found and that matched Terry Hobbs' DNA was located on the ligatures of Michael Moore. It also matched the DNA of 1.5% of the population of West Memphis, or roughly 450 people. The hair that matched David Jacoby's was consistent with 7% of the town population, or about 2,100 people. Todd Moore, the father of Michael Moore, has rightly pointed out that even if it was Terry Hobbs' hair, it could easily be from transfer, since Michael often played at his house. In conjunction with this finding, around this time, Pam's family began to accuse him of being involved in Stevie's death. He divorced his wife Pam in 2004 and built further ill will by shooting his brother-in-law Jack Hicks, who eventually died years later from complications relating to the gunshot wounds. Terry would be sentenced to 6 months in prison for this incident. Pam and her family began to allege that he sexually molested her daughter and masturbated in front of his stepson before he was murdered and forced him to watch. Hobbs was also accused by Pam of regularly taking drugs and of beating his stepson with a whip. It was observed by many that Terry Hobbs did not show any particular care or sadness in the immediate days after Stevie died. There is footage of his reaction at the time in the documentary, Paradise Lost, and also in the West of Memphis documentary too. Pam claimed that they found Stevie's prized pocket knife in a box in Terry's dresser a number of years after Stevie's murder. The knife was, according to Pam, with Stevie on the day he was murdered. Pam also stated that Terry removed Stevie's personal things from their house to the trunk of his car after a fight with his wife in the days shortly after Stevie's murder. Terry Hobbs' alibi came under fire too when his friend David Jacoby said that Hobbs was not with him for the time period that Terry had claimed. Terry had said, after dropping his wife off at work at 5 p.m, that he went to the Moore's house with Amanda and met Mark Byers, who was looking for Christopher at roughly 6 p.m. Mark Byers would later deny this. Hobbs then said he went to David Jacoby's house around 6 p.m, dropped Amanda off, and left with David to search for Stevie. He also claimed that around 20 to 40 people searched with him at that time, though none of the children had officially been declared missing at his point. Terry Hobbs was confirmed to meet up with the searching parents at 8:30 before picking his wife up at 9 p.m. His wife claimed that he did not tell her Stevie was missing until after he had gone inside the restaurant to make a phone call. And Terry's sister-in-law said the day after the boys disappeared, Terry was washing a lot of laundry at odd hours, which was strange because Terry never did washing. He always left household chores to Pam. In 2007, David Jacoby claimed that Terry Hobbs had come to his house around 5:30 p.m. The two men played guitars for an hour before Terry left and left Amanda with David and his wife to look after, and coming back to collect her sometime close to 8 p.m. At 8 p.m., Terry and David Jacoby searched for 15 minutes around the Mayfair apartments, Jacoby stated. Other men would accuse Terry Hobbs of murdering Stevie, calling it the Hobbs family secret. They claimed that Michael Hobbs Jr., the nephew of Terry Hobbs, had told them Terry had confessed to him about murdering the boys. The witnesses that came forward about the Hobbs family secret would be disputed by Michael Hobbs Sr., who would call the claims ridiculous and say that the people had a vendetta against his family because Michael Hobbs Jr. had snitched on them in jail. Three women also came forward and claimed that they saw Terry Hobbs, quote, holler at the three boys to come to his house at 6:30 p.m., which would make him one of the last people to see the victims alive. Terry Hobbs claims that he didn't see any of the three boys that day. The witness sightings placing Hobbs together with the boys contradicts other sightings in 1993, in particular Brian Woody's sighting. It should be pointed out that Brian Woody initially said he saw a fourth boy and that he was going quickly down an intersection, which would mean that the time frame to actually see the victims was just a few seconds, as I spoke about in episode 1. A few years before the murder of his stepson, Terry Hobbs was overheard by his neighbour, Mildred French, beating his wife Pam in their home. French had gone to the Hobbs home to check if everything was okay, when Terry gave her a mouthful of abuse and expletives and sent her packing, telling her to mind her own damn business. The following day, French was taking a shower within her home when Terry Hobbs broke into her house and sexually assaulted her. He only stopped and left her premises when French screamed continuously until he ran off. Hobbs was questioned about this incident under oath in 2008, where he found recalling the incident to be highly amusing to himself. Terry Hobbs is 66 years old today and still lives in Arkansas. The West Memphis Three, town rumors. Those familiar with the case have heard it, and whilst I would not normally add rumors into an episode like this, it's something I am going to reference just slightly, purely because whenever you discuss this case and those suspects who could possibly be involved, this rumor regularly comes up in the conversation. I will be clear though, this is a rumor. The rumor alleges that Terry Hobbs, David Jacoby, L.G. Hollingsworth, and Buddy Lucas were all involved in the murders of the three children. Allegedly, the children had entered the Robin Hood Hills woods playing when they stumbled across the four men having sex in the woods. This rumor originated with accusations from two men, Benny G and Billy S, who claimed that Buddy Lucas had confessed everything to them. Benny also claims to have obtained a confession from Hollingsworth while in jail. Billy claimed to have seen Hobbs kissing Jacoby. They gave sworn affidavits and contacted Pam Hobbs' lawyer when she launched a lawsuit against the state, seeking to re-examine some evidence. There are some solid points brought up in the piece, mainly in pointing out the inconsistencies of Jacoby's testimony, analyzing the contents of Stevie's stomach to point out that it's possible he went home and ate dinner, and linking up Hollingsworth's laundry saga into something coherent. Furthermore, there are a number of rumors and stories circulating West Memphis at the time of Terry Hobbs and his relationship with David Jacoby, and also several other men. Rumors which circulated both before and after the murders. Here are some issues with the theory, though. 1. L.G. Hollingsworth and Buddy Lucas had no known connection to Terry Hobbs at the time. They had much more interactions with the convicted teenagers. 2. A large part of the rumor relies on Aaron Hutchison's testimony for much of its speculation. Presuming this theory is correct, Hutchison does not give a very accurate description. He alleges there were five men, some white, some African-American, and giving a rather strange description of them having sex. He describes it as the men all laying on top of each other in a stack. Though he was an 8-year-old boy at the time, it must be said. 3. The two men who came forward about Buddy and LG are both serving long prison sentences and seem to have minimal credibility. It's entirely possible that they came forward for the attention. Although, on the flip side, just because they are both serving prison sentences doesn't mean they cannot be trusted about anything at all. What are your thoughts? As I stated, these are the town rumors. I won't go into any more detail or discuss them further. But information and further lurid details are easily accessible online if you'd like to read into them a little more and gain further local knowledge. James Kenny Martin. Now, here is quite possibly the creepiest suspect in this case. James Kenny Martin contacted the West Memphis police to help them understand the mind of a criminal. A convicted child molester, Martin had spent 3 years in a Colorado jail for abusing his stepchildren and remains a convicted sex offender to this day. He walked the West Memphis police through the mindset of someone attracted to children, claiming that there were other ways to sexually abuse children without penetrating them and offering up different theories of what he thought could have happened, naming one of the children's parents as a probable perpetrator. In his May 19th, 1993 interview and polygraph session, he would also show knowledge of a crucial piece of inside knowledge: the shoelaces used to tie up the victims. No other suspect subsequently interviewed came up with the information, it should be noted. He brought up his knowledge of it after flunking the polygraph question about what was used to tie up the three boys. He said that he thought it must be shoelaces, since the killer would want to use what was on hand. This contradicted what he said earlier, when he told the police that he thought the killer would bring all of his own tools. His car also had links to the crime scene. He owned a blue Toyota, the same kind of car that was described as visiting the Blue Beacon truck wash around 10 p.m. on the night of the murders. The police also placed a blue Toyota near the crime scene at 6:30 p.m., driven by a large black male. Mention would be made later of a heavy-set black male at the 76 truck stop further on in the night by Blue Beacon truck wash employees. Finally, the alibi he presented to the police makes pretty much no sense. He claimed to have known about the missing children at 5 or 6 p.m., 2 hours before they were even reported missing. This from talking to his mistress. He also said that he was at home with his wife until he left for work at 10 p.m. His wife gave only the barest of interviews and said that Martin was home with her that night, never being pressed further. His mistress, on the other hand, claimed that she came over to Martin's house that day and stayed until sunset, something that Martin utterly dismissed. In general, his whereabouts that evening cannot really be considered accounted for. It's worth adding that in psychology terms, it's quite common for a perpetrator to place himself into the aftermath of a criminal case or investigation, sometimes offering to help police or contribute towards searches for missing people. This could be to find out what's going on or what the police know, but also due to an aspect of both denial and guilt which is affecting their psyche. There is no evidence to suggest that is what happened here, of course. LG Hollingsworth. LG Hollingsworth, Narlene's nephew, is perhaps the most enigmatic and sketchy character in a whole town full of strange and suspicious people. A suspect in the crime himself, LG would behave in various just plain weird ways during the day of May 5th, 1993, and his story would frequently change under police pressure. The tale begins when his aunt Narlene called the police on May 9th and claimed that her nephew had been at the laundromat at 9 p.m. the night of the murders and knew inside information before anyone else. In Narlene's May 10th interview, she claimed that LG had gone to the laundromat in a borrowed car with a box that smelled terrible. LG had lied to her about the laundromat, and apparently certain members of the Hollingsworth family were beginning to get suspicious. A teacher also said that one of LG's relatives had come up to her and confessed that LG came home the night of the murders with bloody clothes and a foul-smelling box. This same relative later denied this happening when asked by the police later in June. LG's grandmother, who worked at the laundromat in question, also said that LG had shown up at 9:30 p.m. and asked for Dominie Tears' telephone number. LG told the police on May 11th that he had been with his friend Richard S. from 5:30 to 9:30 the night of the murders, before going home and talking on the phone to Dominie that night. His friend Richard and Richard's roommate claimed that LG had not been over that night and that they had all hung out together the following day. However, Richard's roommate also claimed in the newspaper that he had been out of town when the boys were murdered. One thing is fairly consistent. Richard consistently claimed that he had not lent LG his car that night. Richard was re-interviewed again at the end of the month of May, and at first backed up LG's story. He then failed a polygraph and recanted. LG's grandmother also claimed that the car he was driving was not Richard's. LG did not own a car. Then came the September statement, in which LG presented an utterly incoherent account of his day on May 5th. His aunt claimed that she took him job hunting at 9 a.m. that day, and that she took him home at 4:20 p.m. LG first said that he took his aunt's kids over to school that morning. Then he said that actually his aunt had picked him up and dropped off the kids before taking him job hunting. He was with his aunt most of the day, though he would claim to have gone to his cousin Dominie's about 1 p.m. This would be virtually impossible, since he also testified that during the day he went out to lunch, then tried to go home but went over to his mother's house to get a key, then got into an accident and then went to the insurance company all in quick succession. He also said that shortly after he got home around 5 p.m. that he went with his mother and her friend to the friend's house. He also said in the same statement that his mother did not arrive home until 7:30 or 8:30 p.m. He then said around that time frame that he had actually gone to Richard's house. To add to this, you have LG's relative claiming that LG worked that night, even though LG and Narlene claimed they were job hunting. The most incriminating thing to come out about LG during the investigation was an anonymous tip claiming that they had overheard Dominie and Damien confessing to killing the boys and that LG had laundered their clothes for them. This also dovetails with the sighting of the two boys and a girl at the laundromat at 10 p.m., though there are no reliable witnesses placing Damien, LG and Dominie there together. Clear as mud, right? A few small additional mentions that I would like to add. In June 1993, the West Memphis Police Department received a report about a man in Utah. He had apparently been talking about the West Memphis murders to a group of women, who he made extremely uncomfortable with his choice of discussion. He had also claimed to know that one of the boys' genitals had been cut off during the crime, and told the women that he had served time in prison for homicide. Most damningly of all, he said that he was actually in West Memphis during the time of the murders. This man spoke with officers in the area, but was not substantially pressed about his claims, and the West Memphis police chose not to investigate further. The Hitchhiker. Now, all credit goes to jivepuppy.com for this suspect, since I could not find any reference of them whatsoever on Callahan. A man named Ken G claimed that on May 5th, he had picked up a hitchhiking man and dropped him off at West Memphis around 3:30 p.m. The hitchhiker was in his late 20s, seemingly angry, and apparently had a tattoo of the devil on his forearm. Though some named people in the case have been put forth as the identification of the man that Ken picked up, Ken would tell jivepuppy.com that none of the potential suspects looked like the man that he saw that day. The families of the deceased children are divided in their opinions as to who were responsible for the deaths of their children. In 2000, the biological father of Christopher Byers, Rick Murray, stated that he had significant doubts as to the guilt of the three teenagers, by then men, who were convicted by the state. Pamela Hobbs, the mother of Stevie Branch, has also been vocal in her opinion that the guilty verdicts against the West Memphis Three were the wrong ones. She has added her voice to the many in calling for a reopening of the case and for further investigation into the new evidence, and in particular, the DNA evidence. In late 2007, John Mark Byers, who was previously vehement in his belief that Eccles, Miss Kelly, and Baldwin were guilty, also announced that he now believes that they are innocent. Both John Mark Byers and Pamela Hobbs have also been vocal in their belief that the real murderer of the children was Terry Hobbs, although to this day, Hobbs has not been formally investigated or charged. The parents of Michael Moore are known to avoid the press and limelight, though they have both voiced their support for the guilty verdict of the West Memphis Three, stating they believe the convictions to be the right ones. In 2010, District Judge Brian S. Miller ordered Terry Hobbs, the stepfather of victim Stevie Branch, to pay $17,590 to Dixie Chicks singer Natalie Maines for legal costs stemming from a defamation lawsuit he filed against the band. Judge Miller dismissed the suit Hobbs filed over Maines' remarks and writings, which implied that he was involved in the killing of his stepson. At the time of the ruling, Hobbs publicly refused to pay a single cent to Maines. It's unknown if he ever did part with the cash that he was ordered to. Judge Miller said that Hobbs had chosen to involve himself in public discussion over whether the convictions were, quote, just or right. To be very clear, a longtime FBI agent and criminal profiler by the name of John E. Douglas stated on record that the murders were indicative of a single killer, intent on degrading and punishing the victims. It was clear, he added, that the murders were not perpetrated by a trio of unsophisticated teenagers acting by chance. Douglas stated that the perpetrator had a violent history and was familiar with both the victims personally and also with the local geography. He stated in his report for Eccles' legal team that there was no evidence the murders were linked to satanic rituals and that post-mortem animal predation would explain the alleged knife injuries. The victims, he said, had died from a combination of blunt force trauma and drowning, in a crime which he believed was driven by personal cause and anger. Douglas served as FBI unit chief for the investigative support unit of the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime for 25 years. He has investigated and advised on numerous high-profile crimes and is considered the highest most expert on criminal profiling in the United States of America. So here we are. Here ends the series. I want to thank you all for being such a supportive and patient listener group. Thank you to each and every one of you who has reached out via email or social media to discuss the case and its many elements over the past few weeks. As always, I thoroughly enjoy sharing my thoughts and discussing the case at hand. With anyone who wishes to reach out, there's always a lot to be discussed. This case is no exception. Please get in touch and let me know your thoughts, opinions, and theories. It's heartening to know that people still want justice for the three boys, even now, 30 years later. I would like to finish with a brief memoriam to the victims. To Stevie Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers. May your souls rest in peace and you find happiness and eternal comfort wherever you may be. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.